Good morning. It is time to begin. We're picking up where we left off in Genesis chapter 7. Genesis chapter 7 is where we left off last time. We talked about our themes through the book of Genesis. Talked about Noah and the flood and how God decided to punish all the people of the earth because their mind was only on evil continually, and how Noah was saved from that wicked generation because he drew near to God and because he obeyed God. Noah pleased God, and he did so because he had faith in God, because he trusted in God. And we can learn a lot about his obedience, and that's where we're going to pick up this week. We talked about the kind of the facts there of the flood, that the water came from above and below, that it rained for 40 days and nights, that the water prevailed on the earth by 15 cubits, so the water was covered until it went back into its natural boundaries, and all life that was not on the ark was killed, and that Noah was on the ark for just over a year. And we left off kind of with the discussion about the severity of the flood and what does that teach us about God. One of the things I wanted to mention about that was, yes, you have this unfortunate view that God is not a merciful and graceful God, because he was so severe and harsh at times in the Old Testament. And so people began to see, you know, the New Testament God is all about love and the Old Testament God was wrath. When that's, I don't even want to call it an oversimplification, it's just wrong. God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. But you can't ignore the wrath of God, that other side of him that I guess maybe just makes people uncomfortable in today's day and age. Many folks, when they want to become a Christian, their idea of what a Christian is to be, I mean, what are we doing? We're trying to become more like Christ, more like God. And their idea is that in order to be virtuous, you must be harmless, completely harmless. I don't see, yeah, Christ was called the Lamb, but he's also the Lion and the Lamb, the Lion of Judah, that God has a fearsome side, that we're, when we're called to fear God, we think about how powerful God is, that he could conjure a cataclysmic event that would destroy the world. It's kind of scary. And yeah, we should be afraid of God, and not so afraid and petrified that we wouldn't understand his love. But there is a side to God that if he's going to be fair, if he's going to be just, if he's going to be moral, he has to punish the evil. If we just allowed evil to run rampant in our society, for the worst of society to enforce their will on the weak and the vulnerable, that wouldn't be right. It wouldn't be right for good men to stand by and do nothing while the innocent were suffering. And so we spent some time last week talking about, was it right for God to flood the entire earth? And if the entire earth was wicked, save Noah, he really saved Noah through that punishment. And as we saw through all of our previous studies in Genesis, Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel, that the punishment oftentimes it's designed to return people to the Father. Now, fortunately, as we're going to get to at the end of this lesson, God promised never to destroy the earth again in this manner with water. But it does teach us some lessons. Any thoughts on the severity of the flood and God and his character before we move on?
We shouldn't forget his patient side. Noah was preaching for over 100 years.
That's right. How long did it take Noah to build the ark? And during all that time, we read in the scripture that he was a preacher of righteousness, that he was telling people. And so you're absolutely correct about that. This misconception that God is, just strictly speaking, wrathful. Well, God gave them every opportunity to repent. He gave them years and years and years to straighten out their ways. They chose not to be with him. And the same is true today. People criticize God, which is kind of silly, but they do. They criticize God and say, how could a loving God send someone to hell? Well, they're choosing not to be with him. They're choosing their destination. They're choosing their destiny, where they want to go, whether they want to obey. So the lesson in it for us is, you know, that, yeah, there's a finality to life, but it's based on our choices on what our destiny will be. Yes, Ron.
You know, back in the sixth chapter, whenever we see how the Lord viewed the earth back then, he said, and it's recorded in verse 5, then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart, man's heart, was only evil continually. God had given man, it was, best we can tell, a natural law, you know, of how good versus evil behavior was defined, and man defiled that. And, you know, God is meting out just punishment, you know, for what man had done. And you're right, it was year after year, decade after decade, hundreds, centuries after centuries, that man had the ability to reform. He did not, to the point that it was evil continually on the earth.
Yeah, you brought up natural law. I suppose this is as good a time as any to bring it up in our study in Genesis. Haven't talked about dispensationalism and the different dispensations, the different covenants God made with his people. God's about to make a covenant with all of mankind that he wouldn't flood the earth again, and with the rainbow and all that after the flood. Shortly after that, Lord willing, next week we'll get into Abraham. He's going to make a covenant with Abram. And God made special covenants with certain people, but just because God made his covenant with the Jews doesn't mean that other people just had no idea what God's will is for them. With our discussion that we just moved on from with Cain and Abel, it doesn't tell us exactly what God had told them in terms of what sacrifice God expected from Cain and Abel, just that Cain's sacrifice wasn't pleasing. During this time, God did speak with people directly. In the Old Testament days, he did this frequently. And you could go to Jonah with Nineveh, that God, and Melchizedek, as we'll get into as well, Lord willing, next week with Abram. That God had prophets and priests and people that went outside just the Jews. This is before the Jewish dispensation. Many people refer to this as the patriarchal dispensation, where God would talk to the heads of the family, God would talk to the fathers, and he would make clear what his will is. So to your point, Ron, absolutely. Do they have an excuse for not obeying, whether you call it natural law or whether he spoke to them directly, or whether they had Noah himself to preach to them? Yes, it seems severe, but the certainly the punishment was severe, but the punishment fit the crime. They were severely wicked, severely evil, to the point, as we said last week, where they were only thinking about evil continually. And it got to the point where society was extremely violent and dangerous. That, yeah, he saved his remnant and his people. So we absolutely need to make sure we are part of that remnant and recognize that God does have that side where he has to punish evil. And if we, would heaven be heaven if it was filled with wickedness? No. To be in God's presence, he has to punish and to be just. Yes, Joe.
We have a problem with authority. We've been told that God can give worship to whom he will give worship. God didn't need an excuse to destroy the world. God made the world. God is in charge. God can do, he was just that. I'm not making that up. But if he wanted to destroy the world, he wanted to create it. So he created it. We need to learn who's in charge and obey his word.
It would be like, yeah, it would be like you creating a little model town and then deciding you need to start from scratch because it wasn't the way you wanted it. Yeah, it's easy for man to try to mock God or criticize him when he's clearly the superior being who created everything, more wise, more powerful, and just to realize who he is. Yeah, people don't like a king. They don't like the idea of submitting. But God certainly is someone, obviously to be feared, but he is in a position of authority over us. It is quite silly for man to mock at God. And maybe that's why they had gotten so wicked in the first place, was they no longer had fear of God. They no longer had respect for him. And they, like you said, they did not see him as authority over them. And I hate to say they got what was coming to them, but that was their choice. And we certainly want to learn from that mistake. Okay, anything else on the flood? So I also want to think about Noah in the context of how long and drawn out this whole process was. Now, the severity of the flood and the amount of time that this took. You think about how much time it took for Noah and how much work to build a giant ship. I don't think that they had iPhones. I don't know if people were able to just deliver stuff to him that he could just order it. He probably had to do a lot of the cutting of the lumber and all the resources he might would have had to dedicate towards this project to put his life on hold, all the ridicule that people would have for him as he preached for all this time it took him to build this ark. And then he gets on the ark, and after last week, I was talking with someone, I can't remember who, and we discussed the idea that I think it was Carrie, would the ark have been able to survive a man-made ship? I mean, even the Titanic sank, okay, with our modern technology. Can you imagine a giant ship made of wood surviving a cataclysmic event that was this violent in nature to flood the entire earth coming from above and below without God's passage? But also, Noah being safely ushered through. To me, obviously, it was a miracle that they survived such a thing. I mean, that the animals just... I don't think he had to go and capture all the animals. I think God just had the animals come to him and go up onto the boat, onto the ark. That it was clearly a miracle. What lessons do you think Noah would have learned from surviving such a violent experience, and that he got safe passage through all that? Renee, do you have something? Was it on a different topic?
I was just going to add, you keep talking about the past and the present of the flood. To me, the worst part was after the flood. No ball bearings for your wheels, no roofing tiles for your house, no thatch. You know, he's got a little family there. There's not a village to help build anything. So to me, the harder part was after the flood, trying to make a living. And so
there would have been challenges.
Now he's really got, you know, a mindset on what all this means.
Yeah, last week we briefly mentioned, you know, on one hand, the convenience of being able to run down to the store. I don't know what kind of stores they had back then, but they had some form of civilization. There might have been certain conveniences from that with just their family left over, in some ways life would have been harder. In other ways, life would have been much easier because society had become so evil, so corrupt, so violent that it might have been nice and quiet and peaceful. And yeah, they probably had to work a little harder in some ways. But life was probably a lot simpler. That you had to go to work to get put food on the table and shelter and all those things. It's a good point. What kind of an impact would that and all of these other things we've been discussing have had on Noah? What do you think he would have learned through this experience?
Don't have kids.
Well, in order to replenish the earth, he would have had to have kids. And fortunately, he was a strong man who his kids were faithful. Yes.
Out of the mightiness of God, that God had faith in him from the building to when he went off. So then he had faith that God would take care of him after they got out of the ark.
Yeah, certainly he had faith to even build the ark in the first place. You think it affirmed his faith that what God said was going to happen, happened? You think he had a lot more trust in God and a lot more faith in God afterwards, after the flood, when he went through all this ordeal? I certainly think it would have had to have had an impact. Life always has an impact on us based on our experiences. And this one, for sure, I think he would have learned not only the power of God, like you said, but to learn how to trust that God will provide and protect you, because he was completely helpless on the ark. And God took care of everything for him until they got off the ark, when they resumed to use a modern term, a new normal. Certainly God would have learned that. Any other thoughts? Yes.
You know, we think the majority can't be wrong. All these people. And you know, you want to go over here, but they have 1,000 people over here. But you know what? God's people really have been the minority. I mean, Joshua and Caleb, they were the minority. And these 8 people, you know, you think there's not security.
Yeah, you're right. That's kind of a fallacy that people fall into. Just because everyone else thinks things ought to be a certain way doesn't mean that they're right. And the vast majority of the world, with only the exception of one family, was wicked, but they were not right. And we should learn that lesson as well. Renee?
I was pointing to her.
Oh, okay. Any other thoughts? Okay, let's talk about the covenant that he made with his people, but with the only people left, with all of mankind. God's covenant with all of creation. Chapters 8 and 9 here, we see that God promised never to flood the earth with water again, and that he reestablished order on the earth. Let's go look at Genesis chapter 8. Chapter 8 and verse 20 says that Noah built an altar to the Lord and took every clean animal, every clean bird, and offered a burnt offering on the altar. God smelled a soothing aroma, and the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake. Although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, nor will I again destroy every living thing that I have done. So what we see here is that God kind of acknowledges that there is an element of human nature where we err, where I have children. I think they're sweet and innocent, but, you know, they make mistakes. They do things that are wrong. They have to be taught not to do things that are wrong. And God recognizes this is just a reality of life, but that God wasn't going to do this again to man as a result of that. And what we're going to see here, and what we're going to see into next week's lesson, is God had a solution for our sin problem. And it had gotten so bad that he had to take drastic action here. But here he's making a covenant with all of man that he wasn't going to do this again. And in chapter 9, verse 11, it says, thus I establish my covenant with you again. Never shall all flesh be cut off by waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. God said, this is a sign of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. It shall be me when I bring the cloud over the earth, and the rainbow shall be seen in the cloud. I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature and all flesh. The water shall never again become a flood and destroy all flesh. The rainbow shall be in the cloud, and I will look on it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. What we see here is that God made this promise to them that he wasn't going to destroy the earth again. And he said this to Noah, but he meant this for all generations, that he established this covenant. I have established this covenant between me and all flesh that is on the earth in verse 17. And what we're going to see here is this idea of a covenant. I think it's worth spending a little time this morning talking about just what a covenant is. That's not necessarily language that is in our vernacular that we use all the time in our daily lives. It's kind of seen as a religious term today. In the olden days, they would make covenants with each other all the time. Some of them would even make blood covenants where, I don't know if you ever played Cowboys and Indians, I guess that's not politically correct anymore, but I played that when I was a kid, and one of the things was blood brothers, right? They would cut their wrists and rub it together, and now we're blood brothers. There were a lot of ancient rituals that people did that they took very seriously. There was more than just a contract. It was a solemn thing that kind of represented, you know, let my blood be shed if I don't fulfill my end of the covenant. When you think about God making a covenant with man, he's made a promise here. We know God's always faithful to his word, even when man breaks faith, breaks trust. Men break contracts. They are not true to their word. God is always true to his word. Did God have any business where he had to make a covenant with man? No. He didn't have to do this. He didn't have to make a promise. Like Gerald said before, God doesn't have to explain himself to us. But he loves us, and he did make that promise to us. And as we're going to see, you have the Old Testament or the Old Covenant and the New Testament, the New Covenant, where there's a lot of symbolism. The sign of the covenant here, under the Jewish dispensation and the Christian dispensation that we talked about earlier, where God creates a new covenant, where he didn't just necessarily only talk to the patriarchs, but he revealed his word through the Bible that we have today, how you could become one of his people. God has made a lot of covenants with people, and this one is a big one because it's made with all mankind. He made a special covenant with the Jews in Genesis chapter 17, and we'll cover this again whenever we get there, but Genesis chapter 17, verse 11, he says, you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskins, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. God made a covenant with Abram and changed his name to Abraham. We'll get to that. He went through that ritual. We'll dig into that a little deeper when we get there. That was part of their ritual, making a covenant, making a solemn covenant that God is now part of his family, and Abraham was then a part of Abram, was now part of God's family, and that's why he changed his name, and that's why they went through. There's some interesting little rituals they were there, but circumcision, which is a real act of faith for a full-grown man to undergo a medical procedure like that, that he would say, you can't be a part of my covenant special people unless you have the sign of the covenant, which was circumcision. Now we're under, not under the old law, as we've been studying through Romans. We're under a new dispensation. We're under a new covenant that God initiated through the shedding of his son's blood. And what is the sign of the covenant today? And let's turn over to Colossians real quick. Colossians chapter 2. Verse 11. says, in him you were also circumcised with the circumcision made without hands, putting off the body of sins of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ, buried with him in baptism, in which you were raised with him through faith in the working of God who raised him through the dead. And you being dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, he has made alive together with him, having forgiven you all your trespasses, having wiped out the handwriting of requirement that was against us, which is contrary to us. He has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. So what we read here is, when God made promises to people, there was a contract element to it. And there were promises made. The sign that he was never going to flood the earth again was, the sign of the covenant was, a rainbow in the sky. Every time you look up at that rainbow, you say, yeah, I remember. God promised not to flood the earth again. Well, God told his people when he made covenants with them in the future that what is going to be the sign of this covenant? Circumcision. What is the sign of our covenant today? Baptism. Baptism, God saves us with water, just like he saved Noah with water here. In 1 Peter chapter 3, can't go to Noah without bringing up this verse here. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 18. First Peter, chapter 3, verse 18. For Christ suffered once for the sins, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive by the Spirit, by whom he also went and preached to the spirits in prison, who formerly were disobedient, when once the divine long-suffering waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is, eight souls, were saved through water. There is also an anti-type, which saves us. Baptism. Not the removal of the flesh, not the removal of filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience towards God through the resurrection of Christ, who has gone unto heaven, is at the right hand of God, the angels and authorities and powers having been made subject to him. What we see here is, just like God saved Noah from a wicked generation through water, he makes this exact point in Peter, that God saves us through water today, through baptism. It is our sign of the covenant. It's not a physical sign, it's not circumcision, but it's a spiritual one, that we're appealing to God for a clean conscience. And so if we want to be right with God today, just like all these folks, many of them were not right with God. They did not respond to the preaching or to the message that God had for them through Noah during all this time. You know, how were they saved? Did Noah save himself because he was a really good shipbuilder? Or was he saved because God saved him? So who was it that saved Noah? It wasn't Noah, it was God. And how were they saved? Well, they were saved through his grace. We read that those passages many times. But he was saved through water. And how does he save us today? Well, he saves us in the exact same way today. But even more so, he saves our soul by nailing our sins to the cross, forgiving us. And so, yes, God punishes. Sometimes God corrects. And sometimes God gives us rules and tells us things not to do. He makes covenants with us, ones that we need to obey and to follow. How can we be saved today? The same way Noah was saved. If we live by faith and obedience, do what God says to do, then he'll have mercy and grace on us. What has he asked us to do today? If you believe, be baptized, wash away your sins, and live faithfully to him. Pretty simple, pretty straightforward. Many people try to say that baptism is not necessary. I don't know how they square with this passage. Certainly, God saves us primarily through Jesus. We're going to see a lot of anti-types of Jesus. We kind of already saw one with Abel. He had done nothing wrong, and yet he was killed for doing what was right. Jesus was the same way. Here we see another anti-type, that God's plan was foreshadowed that he was going to save man through water baptism. Okay, any thoughts here on the covenant God makes with man? Jerry?
This is an interesting covenant for several reasons. One, actually when God made a covenant with man, it was in the form of I will meet my responsibility if you meet your responsibility. There is no reciprocal responsibility here.
With the flood, we're talking the rainbow and the flood.
The flood.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. He doesn't say, I won't destroy it with water again if y'all will be good at it. He just says, I'm not going to do that ever again. So it is, even though it is called a covenant, it's not your typical covenant. It is more the promise kind of covenant. That's the first thing. Second thing is, I've always wondered why God made this. I mean, this was totally in the mind of God. And I think, I wonder if this wasn't an extremely emotional thing for God to do, to destroy these people. I wonder if this doesn't indicate how detestable this was to God, even though he had to do it. There's one sense of the flood that shows that God is bound and determined to punish sin, which is 2 Peter 3. These people who don't believe that God's going to come in flaming fire and burn this world up need to remember the flood.
That's right.
And so there is the element of God's justice and God not tolerating sin. But I think in this section, there is that emotional aspect with God. Sin hurts God, and having to punish people for sin hurts God. It's not like God is sitting up in heaven as this totally distant being who, you know, first time his people get out of line, he's going to come down hard on them. That oftentimes is a picture that people present of God in the Old Testament. It's not. How often did he bend over backwards to be merciful to people? And I think this is one of those situations where we see a God who loves his creation, especially his human creation. And what an emotional thing it was for him, how much it must have hurt him to have to do this, to the point that he says, I'm promising you I will never do this again.
Takes a loving God to make a covenant like this when he doesn't have to. It's a good point. Good point. Yes?
I think it's more important now to teach people, or to teach our young people, what the true meaning of the rainbow is. Unfortunately, in society, in the world, the rainbow is being used for something not of God. So I think it's more important now that we try to teach what the meaning of that is, and that it is the covenant that God's doing, not destroying it.
It has been co-opted, to use a modern phrase, the rainbow, to represent that God wouldn't punish his people. Somewhat ironically, that people are using it to celebrate sin today. I find it ironic because it has to do with a promise not to punish by water, but God does promise that there will be judgment to come. Ironically, they're parading around under God's mercy and grace, a symbol of God's mercy and grace, while openly flaunting a lifestyle that will cause them to be punished later, but he's basically promised them, I'm not going to do it right now. I'm going to hold off on it. And certainly, I think with all this, God's grace and mercy cannot be questioned. People question it, but it's not right that we don't realize through the proper perspective that God has been lenient, God has been merciful, God has been patient, and God has made man a lot of promises, and God does love us. But he still does expect obedience, and he still does expect us to remember him, remember his rules, and also, yes, remember his promises. And, I certainly think it's wrong to pervert his imagery. That's a good point. Any other thoughts here on God's covenants with man, Ron?
You know, if we look at what 1 John, the first chapter, says, you know, passage we go to oftentimes about our walk with God. It says in verse 5, this is the message which we have heard from him and declare to you, that God is light and in him is no darkness at all. And then you go back to the passage that that I referred to a little bit earlier, Genesis 6, where it says that, you know, God was grieved in his heart. He was sorry that he made man. And that is not an apologetic kind of sorry. You know, that was pretty much utter disgust.
It wasn't
what people were doing.
Yeah. Well, and he wasn't sorry that he had done something wrong.
Right.
He was sorry that he had made man because of the choices that they used with that freedom. Hey, God still gives us the freedom to choose what we're going to do today. It doesn't mean that he likes it. But, you know, this is, it's so symbolic of what's going to happen for us when we finally face judgment. If we want to be in the presence of a perfect, holy God, if we, you know, this world is not a utopian place. It's not a perfect place. But that's what heaven is promised. We know God is promising us paradise. We can't be in paradise if there's, as it says here, only evil continually and violence and all these wickedness. God can't be in the, you know, a light cancels out darkness. And certainly God's cleanses us of our sins, because otherwise none of us would be able to be in his holy presence. But that's what we spend our life trying to do. Noah was able to please God. Noah was able to walk with God. If he can do it, even in the midst of that crooked generation, so can we today. But we have to follow the rules. Yeah, something else?
Yeah, and that's where I was going to go next, is the covenant that God made with man, you know, that he's not going to destroy it by water again. But he does promise that it will be destroyed.
By fire.
By fire. And he gives us a means to come back into that life. Not by our own, you know, good deeds and achievements and all of that, but that we are washed pure by the blood of Christ. And we can stand in that close proximity to God. That passage in James, James chapter 4 and verse 8, that, you know, we draw near unto God. To God, one, he lets us, and two, if we are if we're washed by the blood, then he makes up that difference with us. And what a beautiful covenant it is for those who are trying to be near to God, but it ought to be terrifying to those who choose to just walk in darkness.
Any covenant God makes with man, we don't deserve. And he didn't have to make this promise not to flood the earth again, just like he didn't have to send his son to die for you and for me. He did that because he loves you and me, and there always is a path of redemption. Excellent point. We had one more comment here, and then we're going to move on to the Tower of Babel. Yes.
See it with Abraham's request to spare Sodom and Gomorrah if a certain number of righteous people could be found. But also we find it perhaps even more so with Jonah. the end of Jonah where he's gotten upset about the plant being destroyed by a worm.
He cares more about the plant than the people.
God says, should I not care about the great city of Nineveh, which has more than 120,000 people, who cannot distinguish between their right and their left, as well as many animals?
Yeah, God certainly cares for the innocent. Unfortunately, society had become so corrupt that the only innocent left were on that boat. And I use innocent, you know, commendatively. It's important for us to remember how much God loves and how much He cherishes life. I think the fact that that was a society that did not, was violent and did not appreciate life, drove him to that. And certainly God has that emotional side. Like you said, we're made in God's image. We have emotions, right? God explains His emotions to us in human terms that we try to understand. But certainly God has revealed to us His love. And yeah, He doesn't want to do that. And you're right, Abraham appealed to God's emotions for Sodom and Gomorrah. And it's a good point with Jonah as well, that God clearly cares for His creation. All right, so after this, I guess I forgot to click here. After this, what we see is previously in chapter 1, God had told man to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And after the flood, we have a long genealogy, which we will not take the time to go through the genealogy. But I wanted to fit the Tower of Babel in here before we got to Abraham, because I think it's significant and we can learn a lesson from it. Immediately after the flood, we saw that God knew, he said He knew even from their youth that man had some wickedness that they were going to have to deal with, but He promised not to destroy them anyways. And so God uses a much gentler touch here. Certainly society wasn't quite as corrupt, but essentially what we had here is in chapter 11, verse 4, they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and the tower whose top is in it of itself. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. Well, what had God intended for man from the beginning? He told them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the whole earth. And what did they decide they wanted to do after the flood? Maybe it was kind of this after effect of we kind of have to be self-sustaining and we're trying to rebuild society and we want to be able to have resources and help each other out. There's a reason why people move to this area, because there's jobs, because there's opportunities, because we have modern conveniences, right? So what was the problem with them? Why did God in the Tower of Babel confuse their language and spread them out? What was the problem with them all wanting to stay together? Does that mean, you know, it's sinful and wrong for us to go move to the city? Well, I guess we're out of time to answer that question. I guess we're going to move on to Noah next week. We'll briefly touch on this before we move on. I do want to highlight this before we get to Abraham. But think about, you know, what was the purpose behind the Tower of Babel. But the sheets are in the back for next week. Moving on to Abraham. Thank you.